Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today we will return to the archives and continue reading the February 2020 issue of Guideposts with articles like Change of Direction. Close Calls, Change of Direction, A Raging Prairie Blaze and a Hunter Lost in the Flames by Terry Burleson, Edmond, Oklahoma. In the plains of northwest Oklahoma, you can see for miles nothing but prairie, grass, clumps of cedar trees, and rugged red rock canyons. But even with my binoculars, I could barely make out the helicopters, one after the other, dumping water on a wildfire at the horizon. I wasn't concerned by the small plane, plume of smoke, snaking skyward. It had to be at least 50 miles away, across the southern Canadian River even. That afternoon, my Uncle Larry and Cousin Tony and I had driven to this 4,000-acre ranch for a planned 3 days of turkey hunting. Larry had brought 3 horses for us to use, moseying about the ranch like real cowpokes. At age 57, I was semi-retired from a career in retail management. Felt great to get away for some male bonding. I snapped a few pictures of the bushy cedars, the canyon rims, nothing but blue skies above, and texted them to my wife, Andy, 2 hours away. Nothing to worry about, I typed, having a great time. She'd seen the fire on the news and called a few minutes earlier to warn me, but we lost the cell connection. I didn't want her fretting. I knew she'd be praying regardless. All that talking to God stuff came harder for me. It was hard to imagine him actually listening to anything I'd have to say. The wind had picked up, blowing hard from the southwest. We left the horses in the stable by the ranch house and climbed into a Gator utility vehicle, Larry driving, to scout for places to drive out the gobblers the next day. We headed north on a small gravel road that hugged the ranch perimeter. We stopped here and there to look for signs of turkeys. We drove for about a mile before Larry turned to head back south toward the ranch house. As we did, my eyes went wide. A wall of flames was racing towards us, maybe 3/4 of a mile away. "Get us out of here," I screamed. Larry whipped around, bouncing hard over the gravel road. How had the fire jumped the river? To cover that kind of ground so fast would have taken tornado-like speed. The flames would be on us in no time. What about the horses? What about our trucks? How can we save ourselves? We weren't expecting the answers. We were just trying to keep from totally losing it. I looked back. Amazingly, we were gaining on the fire until we ran out of road. A heavy-duty barbed wire fence blocked the way. There was no way to get the Gator past it. Larry, Tony, and I jumped off and scrambled to the other side, but it hardly mattered. On foot, we were goners. I called Andy. "We're surrounded by fire," I shouted over the howling wind. "Call 911. We need a helicopter to get us out of here." The connection went dead. I looked around. Where were Larry and Tony? The smoke was so thick I couldn't see more than a few feet around me. I yelled for the other guys. All I could hear were the cedars exploding, the dry grass crackling like popcorn. It was terrifying. I reached in my pocket for my cell phone again. Gone. I must have dropped it. That phone was my only contact with the outside world. But there was no time to look further. I stumbled blindly, choking from the smoke. Flames reached out and tagged me, burning my clothes. If I didn't get some fresh air, I was going to die of smoke inhalation. I knelt down, my face near the ground, grasping for breath. I'd never needed God as I did now, but I never felt as if I'd done anything to deserve his help or his love. Andy was up every morning at 5:30 praying and reading the Bible. Me, I'd put nearly everything else in my life first. Work, family, chores. The only times God had felt real to me were Sunday mornings. For years, I'd driven 2 hours every other weekend to look after my mother, mow her property. Driving home, I'd turn on the radio to a station out of Tulsa that played old-time gospel music. Those wide-open Oklahoma skies spreading out before me. I felt as if I were in the arms of the Creator. I never got that feeling anywhere else. I was on my own here. Through the smoke, the flames biting me every step of the way, I made it to the top of the canyon. Momentarily, I was above the fire. To the west, maybe 1/4 mile away, I saw a flat area the fire hadn't reached, a place clear of cedars. I half ran, half staggered there, then collapsed on the ground. I took deep breaths. After a few minutes, I tried to stand. Smoke filled my lungs. I fell back to the ground. Behind me came a roar like a freight train. I looked back. All I could see were towering flames. I pulled myself to my feet. I went one way, then another, the blaze chasing me. Somehow I ended up in an area that had already been burned, the ground charred black. How I'd gotten there, I had no idea. It was as if I'd been carried. I lay on the embers, my scalp, my back burning, blistering. I didn't even have the strength to lift my head. God, please let me live, I cried out in desperation. It was the first prayer I'd said in years. I knew I was too late to expect any favors from God. I only hoped he'd be there for Andy. Let her know I love her, I whispered. Hot wind whipped dirt and ash against me. The fire would be right behind it, burning over me. I dug into my pocket and found a handkerchief. I put it over my nose and mouth, closed my eyes tight. A peace came over me. I was ready to die. I just hope I'd lose consciousness before the flames reached me. A minute passed, then two. I opened my eyes as much as I dared. The flames had burned a kind of fire break into the ground just yards away from me. Now it was blowing away from me. A miracle. I stood and started walking. No idea of the direction I was going. It looked like a war zone. Blackened cedars littering the countryside. Was anybody searching for me? I hadn't seen a single helicopter. In the distance, I saw a windmill and a large round stock tank on concrete slab, a place where I could lie down, away from burning embers. It took every bit of strength I had left, but I got there just as darkness fell. I dipped my handkerchief in the cool water I found, washing soot and ash off my face and wetting my lips. Water, even though it wasn't the cleanest, had never tasted so good. I collapsed onto the concrete. The air was still smoky. How much more could I breathe in before it killed me? Would I even live till morning? I wished I'd been able to tell Andy and my kids how much I loved them. In the distance, I watched as cedars burst like fireworks, the fire ravaging everything in its path. The flames had surrounded me. By any logic, the fire should have consumed me too. And yet, as if a shield protected me, I'd been spared its full fury. I looked up, helicopter lights zipped across the sky, but there was no second pass. No one had seen me. I stared up at the majestic starry heavens. The view went on forever and beyond what my eyes could possibly take in. The only thing I could compare it to were those drives back from my mom's, that overwhelming sense of God's presence. He'd been with me then. He shielded me from the flames today. He would be with me always. I didn't have to do anything to earn his love. I thought of Andy's prayers, the prayers of folks at church he had no doubt asked for. I felt their love too. There on the hard concrete, without another soul around, I felt watched over, a feeling I'd never known before. Thank you, Lord, I prayed, for never giving up on me. Thank you for Andy and the kids and for the life you've given me. The words came freely, easily, as if I were talking to an old friend. I talked to him all night about everything I could think of, making up for lost time. At sunup, I started walking. Before long, I saw a pickup. Two men got out. Have you been out here all night? One asked. We were just going to work at the oil rig, but we'll make sure you get help. You're one lucky dude. Do you have any water? I was downing my third bottle when a silver SUV pulled up. My son Jordan and son-in-laws Mark and Sean and my good friend Don got out. He's alive, they shouted. One of them held a phone to my ear. Everything's going to be okay, Andy said. I love you. The boys explained that Larry and Tony were safe. The horses had survived as well. A helicopter took me to the burn unit in Oklahoma City. As it lifted off, I took one last look at the charred landscape below. Total devastation. More than 280,000 acres would burn. But in the blackness, I saw hope. The promise of a new day dawning, new growth. I was alive because the fire had miraculously changed direction, and so had I. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazines, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Overcoming Loneliness. The hardest assignment for this military wife, starting over, redeployed by Elizabeth Gray, Alexandria, Virginia. Time to move again. My husband's next set of military orders arrived. Cody is in the Army. He was being assigned to Fort Hood, Texas, 1,500 miles from our home in Alexandria, Virginia. This would be our sixth move since our oldest daughter, Morgan, was born. In those 11 years, we'd moved about every 2 years. The moves were hard on Morgan, though eventually she managed to make friends. Her younger sisters, Bryn and Hadley, mostly seemed fine. The one who dreaded these moves most of all? Me. I'm an introvert. Some people get energized by rooms of strangers. Social situations drain me. My comfort zone is my job. I'm a licensed clinical social worker who works on military family programs, my family, and my home. My idea of a good day? A productive time at work, home at a reasonable hour, dinner with Cody and the kids, a cozy evening reading a book or looking at something online. Over the years, I've developed a small network of close friends, but making friends is hard for me. Meeting new people always feels forced. I have no idea what to say that doesn't sound fake. I'd rather stay home. Every 2 years, I went through the ritual known to most military families. Pack the house, say goodbye, drive thousands of miles, find a place to live, usually off post, enroll the kids in school, find a babysitter, a dentist, and a hairdresser, the true trifecta of a military move, a church. Last, the hardest item on the list, for me anyway, make friends. At least it's Fort Hood, I said to Cody. Fort Hood is one of the largest military installations in the world, with more than 36,000 soldiers and some 12,000 civilian employees. Surely we knew someone. Cody scanned his mental Rolodex. Is Anne still there? He ventured, naming someone we'd known a few years earlier. She just retired and moved, I said. What about Brad? He and his family are in North Carolina now, Cody said. We went back and forth. There has to be someone, I said. There wasn't. Packing the house, I felt a creeping sense of dread. You'd think by this time I'd have mastered this process. Instead, it just seemed to be getting harder, especially the friend part. The thought of yet another round of meet and greets, stilted conversations, and trial and error coffee runs sapped my spirit. Anyone who knew someone at Fort Hood? I asked my social media network. No one did. In the military, all your friends moved too. Driving to Texas, I realized there was an even deeper layer to my dread. We'd made a home in Northern Virginia, finding friends at work and in our neighborhood, our daycare and our daughter's Girl Scout troop. We'd all said goodbye to a place and people we loved. Now, as we headed into the unknown, I felt weighted down by grief. A familiar temptation came over me. Maybe I could just skip making friends and consider this posting a retreat from social life. Introverts like to be alone, right? Immediately, I remembered the time several years earlier when I needed emergency surgery while Cody was off on deployment. The kids had ended up in the care of strangers because I'd failed to find people to list as their emergency contacts at daycare. It's a common dilemma for military families. Often you show up somewhere in the middle of the school year, you know no one, relatives live far away. Who comes to pick up your kids when you can't? I've asked people I just met at a party to be my kid's emergency contact. I've been asked the same question. After the surgery debacle, I begged God for help making friends. God did not answer that prayer by giving me a sudden infusion of extroversion. Still, I always managed to make at least one or two friends wherever we moved. I knew I should ask God for help again, but I also knew what help felt like, the enormous reluctance, the awkward introductions, the strained conversations. I just didn't feel up to it. Of course you can do it, my friend Mandy back in Virginia said. She was one of the first people I called when we got to Fort Hood. Mandy makes most extroverts look introverted. She can walk into a crowd of strangers and leave with everyone's phone number. Just talk to people, she said. Get to know them. Easy for you to say, I said. All you have to do is meet one person, Mandy said. Then you get to know that person's people. You can meet one person. Could I? Once before Cody and I had kids, I came back to the U.S. from being stationed in Germany while Cody was still in Iraq. For several months, even after starting graduate school, practically the only people I talked to were the pizza delivery guy and my next-door neighbor, who turned out to be a drug dealer. Those were some of the loneliest months of my life. Introverts like alone time, but we don't like feeling lonely. Who does? I knew what I should do here at Fort Hood. I just didn't know if I had it in me. A month after we arrived, I got an email invitation to meet and greet for military spouses. I tried to convince myself the email had been sent by mistake. It seemed to be addressed only to spouses of soldiers in positions different from Cody's. Let me find out, Cody said. A few hours later, he called back. You're invited, he said. They specifically said they want to make everyone feel welcome. I don't want to go, I said. Why not? You might meet some people. I might win the lottery someday, too, I said, picturing myself standing awkwardly off to the side as women chatted happily. Just go, said Cody. I went, a knot in my stomach and a smile plastered on my face. For a while, I did stand off to the side as women chatted happily around me. I overheard someone say she lived near where Cody and I had found a house. Mandy's voice sounded in my head. Introduce yourself. Maybe she could be your one person. I felt the familiar reluctance. Go, a deeper voice seemed to say. I will be with you. Oh, all right. In order for me to meet that woman, I would have to cut into her conversation. Was there anything more mortifying? What if I introduced myself and everyone just stared at me? I stepped forward. When the conversation paused, I summoned up my strength, stuck out my hand, and said, Hi, I'm Elizabeth. I overheard you say you live near where my family lives. I'm new here, too. I thought I'd introduce myself. Well, that sounded dumb. The woman smiled, and to my amazement, we started chatting about the neighborhood, kids, schools, past deployments. Maybe we could get coffee sometime, I said. I'd love that, she said. We exchanged contact information, texted a few times, and never met up for coffee. So much for that. I tried to convince myself that being alone was preferable to the struggle of making new friends. If loneliness was the price to pay, then so be it. What could I do? A month later, a second meet-and-greet invitation arrived. Apparently, these things happened regularly. I am definitely not going, I said to Cody. The first one was a bust. Just go, he said, then grinned. You know, Starbucks is on the way home. This man knew my weakness. Fine, I said, but I'm also getting a brownie there. I kept my ears open for conversations that sounded promising. Again, I heard someone mention living near me. Without thinking, I plunged in. I think we're neighbors, I said. Me too, another woman standing nearby said. The first woman introduced herself. I'm Lori. I'm Emily, the second woman said. A third woman held out her hand. Justina, I think we all live close to each other. We also had kids at the same school. This time, conversation flowed. We were still talking after the event ended. One of the things we agreed on, how hard it was to move all the time. Not long afterward, we got together for coffee. Talking to these women was so easy. We arranged to meet at the park with our kids. Soon we were getting together for lunch and even going out for dinners periodically. Can I put you down as my kid's emergency contact? I asked Justina. I'd penciled in faraway relatives as a stopgap when we first arrived. Sure, can you be mine? She said. Meet one person. We can't all be extroverts like my friend Mandy is, but with God's help, even the biggest introvert can meet just one person. We can find that emergency contact and so much more. For more on this story, see Family Room. Living with cancer. Prayers for Natalia. My daughter's illness has tested us both. By Egli Cologne Stevens, New York, New York. It's hard to believe that this past year, my beautiful daughter Natalia and I are again dealing with life-threatening challenges to her health. It doesn't seem so long ago that our hopes and faith were tested the first time. In 2007, Natalia walked her first runway at my sister's college fashion show, not far from where we live in Harlem, New York. At 12 years old, my green-eyed girl was already 5'9". She got her height from her father, from whom I was divorced. As I watched her sashay down the runway, I was stunned by how poised and confident she looked. She was a natural. I'm going to be a model, she announced after the show. Well, we'll see about that, I told her. It's good for a child to have a dream. But as the first college graduate in my family, I hadn't gotten a doctorate in urban education and worked as a teacher so that my daughter could be a model. I relented a bit, however, and let my sister do a photo shoot with Natalia. They'd just begun putting together a portfolio in January 2008 when Natalia complained of pain in her right knee. It was so unusual for my happy-go-lucky daughter to complain about anything that I scheduled an appointment with an orthopedist. The cherry blossoms were in full bloom that sunny April day. I took Natalia to the orthopedist. After x-rays were done on her leg, the doctor placed them on a backlit white screen on the wall. He pointed to a spot about the size of a lime on the screen. That lump you see on her thigh bone is a tumor. I grabbed Natalia's hand. That can't be right, I said. Unfortunately, I'm 99% sure it's malignant, a bone cancer that's called osteosarcoma. The good news is that it looks as if we caught it early. I'm referring you to Memorial Sloan Kettering. Natalia's first and only question to the doctor was not, will I live, but will I be able to walk the runway again? How could she ask such a foolish question? She didn't shed a tear, but I broke down in sobs when we reached the parking lot. Do you know something I don't? Natalia said. Stop crying, Mommy. I'm not going to die. In the 3 days leading up to Natalia's biopsy at Memorial Sloan Kettering, I prayed every waking moment. I sent out a mass email to everyone we knew, asking them to join us in prayer for my daughter's healing. My parents and sister came with us to the hospital. Her dad and other Nana met us there. I peppered Dr. Morris, Natalia's orthopedic surgical oncologist, with questions and suggestions. Natalia insisted on knowing everything, even the long-term survival rate for osteosarcoma, which was 70 to 75% if the cancer didn't spread. Dr. Morris told Natalia she'd know she had cancer if she woke up with a bandage on her upper chest. That would mean they inserted a Mediport for chemotherapy. I didn't let go of my daughter's hand until the second she was wheeled into the operating room. I walked down the hallway to the chapel and curled myself into a fetal position in a pew. You know, I always trust in you, Lord, I prayed. But the thought of Natalia being cut open, of her losing, I'd never been so afraid. Please help me surrender this burden to you. Give me your peace. I felt some small measure of release. The nurse came into the chapel to bring me to Dr. Morris. When I saw the box of tissues on the table, I knew what was coming. Natalia's tumor is malignant, Dr. Morris said. We'll start aggressive chemotherapy next week, then remove the tumor and reconnect her leg 3 months from now. Anger and disappointment rose inside me, but I pushed my feelings down so Natalia would not see them on my face when she woke up in the recovery room. As soon as Natalia opened her eyes, she pulled away the sheets and looked down at the bandaged bump of her Mediport. I held my daughter in her arms, and all I could think was, you can't leave me. If you die, I will too. Memorial Sloan Kettering became our battleground in the months that followed. Natalia's chemotherapy regimen was brutal. 3 drug regimens to kill the tumor cells. Less than a month into Natalia's treatment, her hair started falling out in clumps. I found her in the bathroom one morning, shaving her head into a baby mohawk. It wasn't long before even that little shock of hair fell out. To match my daughter's look, I shaved my own hair, and we held our newly shorn heads high all over town. Natalia named the leg with the tumor Will, telling everyone, I will walk again. She named the other leg Grace, for my favorite TV show, Will and Grace. Each round of chemo, Natalia would say, let's get this party started. But by cycle 4, she was so weak that I had to carry her to the wheelchair to go to the hospital, and she slept as many as 38 hours at a stretch. I would lie next to her pleading with God for a miracle as I listened to the melody of my daughter's heartbeat. I felt helpless in the face of her intense pain, but after I set up a blog where we could post updates, I felt at least I was doing something useful. The blog became our bridge to family and friends. In mid-June, we shared the incredible news that Natalia's scans were clear. The cancer wasn't spreading. In addition to removing the tumor and the affected parts of her femur and replacing it with an internal titanium prosthesis, the doctor would also need to do a knee replacement, she said. Will this ordeal ever end, I wondered. Yet Natalia remained as resilient as ever. On the day of her surgery, the rain poured furiously from the sky, just as it had the night Natalia was born. I took it as a sign that the operation would go well, which it did. Natalia finally came home after her string of surgeries, and before she was even out of the wheelchair, she insisted on taking my red stilettos with her to physical therapy. My goal is to be able to walk in these heels, she told the physical therapist. Let's get to work. Within 5 months, Natalia was back to dancing around the house. She ended up putting on so much weight on her leg, she called Will, that it broke along with her internal prosthesis. On January 12, 2009, 9 months after her diagnosis, She finished the last of her agonizing 19 cycles of chemo. In mid-February, another reconstructive surgery was performed. She was left with an 18-inch scar. The worst seemed to be behind us. Natalia had excellent health during her teenage years. I enrolled her in enrichment programs and continued to push her hard in the direction of academics, but she remained as obsessed as ever about a modeling career. At a parent-teacher conference her sophomore year, Natalia's teacher told me she was distracted and not turning in her homework. When I got home that night, I found her practicing her runway walk down the length of our living room instead of doing her schoolwork. "Listen," I told her, "you've got to let go of this modeling idea. You're going to need a good job with security and a stable future." Natalia looked me straight in the eye. "I understand that a regular job can give you security," she said. "But what about joy?" "You know how much I love you, Mommy, but I'm not going to live a life half-lived, not even for you." It was as if we were from different worlds entirely. "Oh, Lord, I asked you, why did you give me such a strong-willed child? I put Natalia on a weekly contract to keep up with her all her schoolwork. If she failed to do so, her privileges for the weekend, such as going out with friends, were revoked. Her academic performance dramatically improved, but she still insisted on modeling in school and community fashion shows. Natalia made her official debut on the runway at a New York bridal show when she was 18. I watched as she glided down the catwalk in a sparkling long white dress. Not only was she breathtaking, but she radiated pure joy and comfort in her own skin. Suddenly I understood. This beautiful dream was what had sustained her through all these grueling trials of her illness and recovery. I clasped my heart for my daughter, bursting with pride that she had fought tooth and nail to reach her goal. While attending college, Natalia did more fashion shows and photo shoots, although she didn't sign with an agent until she was 23. That's when her career really took off. She walked in several shows at New York Fashion Week and was featured in Elle and Vogue magazine. She appeared on season 17 of Project Runway on Bravo TV. As a way to advocate for inclusion and body positivity in the fashion industry, she insisted that her scar on her leg never be airbrushed away in photographs. Then in January 2019, we found ourselves back at Sloan Kettering. Natalia was diagnosed with renal medullary carcinoma, a rare cancer of the kidney. Her right kidney was removed, and in March, she was declared cancer-free. We were ecstatic, but our happiness was short-lived. In mid-October, the doctors informed us that the cancer had returned, this time in her lungs. Natalia decided that after such a horribly draining experience 12 years ago, she would not undergo any chemotherapy. Instead, she embarked on non-traditional treatments. She said, "This is what God is telling me, Mommy." In the years since Natalia became ill the first time, I've learned that God gives me peace in my heart when I'm making the right decision and anxiety when I'm not. Back then, I spent my days drowning in fear and anxiety, unable to fully surrender to the mystery of the unknown. But this time, as I fully support Natalia in her decisions, I am at peace. I can let go because God made my daughter so strong, so grounded in her faith. Her spirit remains unbroken, and so does mine. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.